women are not believed. They feel coming away that they're when they bring up their concerns, they're not, their doctors don't hear them. And so I think that is one of the biggest concerns. The other I've heard is lack of communication, or they're trying to communicate with the provider and the provider is not listening to them. And I think there's a different approach when a woman comes in and wants to talk to her doctor than when a man goes in and talks to the doctor. So I think that is one of the biggest barriers that I think exists.
Until about 25 years ago, almost all health research was conducted on men. Women were actively excluded from participating in most clinical trials. At the same time, women have unique health needs and many health conditions affect women differently to men. Dr. Monica Malapali is a subject matter expert on women's health and sex differences. She's a women's health advocate and thought leader on issues pertaining to women's health across the lifespan, especially migraine. I've also had the pleasure of working together with Dr. Malapali on the steering committee of CHAMP, the Coalition of Headache and Migraine Patients, last year. She has a PhD in genetics and a master's in biochemistry. So if there was ever a need to describe the gender differences between women and men at the molecular level, she would know. Dr. Malapali, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thanks for having me, Carl. It's a pleasure and honor to be here speaking with you today.
You trained as a biomedical scientist with training and research expertise in areas like biochemistry, genetics, and neuroscience. Why did you decide to pursue your own current path as a women's health advocate?
Well, thank you for that. There are two reasons. Let me give you both the reasons. One is a personal reason and one is a professional reason. So personal is I lived with a mother who had heart disease and suffered all her life. She was very successful in her career, but again, you know, had health issues all throughout. I'm from India, so I knew that the healthcare for women was not great before I immigrated to the United States. And I came here with the reason to pursue my PhD here, knowing that, you know, United States was a place to, you know, do research. So that's the side, you know, the personal story. And I was always interested in women's health per se. But then I got an opportunity when I decided to leave research and go into science policy, got an opportunity to work at the Society for Women's Health Research. And that was an eye-opener for me, because for the first time I realized that at the same time while I was getting my PhD, women were not included in research, and I did not know that. So that had a huge impact on me. And I think personally, that's what drove me to be a women's health advocate and really understand why women were missing from research. And I feel like if United States was not leading the effort, how does that impact then other countries, you know, where women's health is still not given the attention that it needs and deserves?
What should women know about how they're treated in a health or medical setting?
So I will answer that slightly differently. I think women don't know how they're treated in a way, but I think what women should know when they go to seek treatment. So by what I mean by that is, you know, there are a lot of things we take for granted, right? Healthcare is one of them. And, you know, you hear a lot of women talk about equal pay, you know, trying to climb the corporate ladder and have the same kind of ambition and drive for a career. But what they don't understand is when it comes to healthcare, we don't have the same parity. So what women don't know when they go to seek care, and like you said in your opening statement, until 30 years ago, there was no research done on women. So I think what women don't understand when they go to seek healthcare or seek treatment is sometimes those treatments may not work on them. So for them, it's very important to be involved to understand, you know, kind of inform themselves and educate themselves when they go to seek medical care.
So one of the issues is the fact that some of the treatments they may be getting recommended have never been tested, or women have never been included in the research studies. What other barriers may women face when they're seeking care?
I think the other barriers that I've heard, and especially this pertains to the migraine community and also pain community in general, are women are not believed. They feel coming away that they're when they bring up their concerns, they're not their doctors don't hear them. And so I think that is one of the biggest concerns. The other I've heard is lack of communication, or they're trying to communicate with the provider and the provider is not listening to them. And I think there's a different approach when a woman comes in and wants to talk to her doctor than when a man goes in and talks to the doctor. So I think that's one of the biggest barriers that I think exists, is trying to effectively communicate with a healthcare provider.
Is that always the case when speaking with female clinicians as well? Or is that primarily when you're seeing a male clinician or doctor?
Again, I think there's a lot of it is anecdotal, so I'm not citing anything here, but I think women tend to say that they feel better, that they're better heard when it's a female doctor, rather than it's a male doctor. But I think we can generalize that. I think it all depends on the specialty, depends on the practice. So there are a lot of other variables there. But one common theme is women feel like they need to be heard. Again, the way they describe their symptoms, they describe their problem is very different than what a man would, how a man would describe.
And how has the pandemic, which is still going on even to this day, affected women's health and their ability to seek, you know, support?
I'm sure it has affected, and I think just not women, but, you know, overall everybody, right? So I think one of the biggest issues has been access to care. So getting the treatment on time, getting, you know, diagnosis on time. You know, we did a survey when the pandemic first broke out, and just to ask, very general, very simple survey, just to ask women, you know, what was, you know, were they receiving the treatment or were they receiving the care? What was the biggest barrier for them? And one of the things they did say was, you know, cancellation of appointments. They were not able to see the provider. And when it came to treatments, they basically said that they were not able to get the treatment that they were seeking, especially treatments such as infusions and injections, which I know it's a big deal for migraine patients, right? So that was the start of the pandemic. We haven't done anything like that recently, that at least that I'm aware of. So I think it'd be good to see things have changed. But let's look at also the positive side, right? The positive side is, you know, like we were just talking about with the Zoom and with, you know, the technology. Now we have telehealth, you know, and so more and more people are using telehealth. There are some challenges. There's some barriers to telehealth too, but definitely there's a wider reach, you know, and the ease of connecting with their doctor. But I think that is definitely, you know, address some of the access barriers.
So if you're someone who has experienced this firsthand, you're a woman, you've described your symptoms to a doctor, you may or may not have been dismissed. Come the, you know, the pandemic, that's made consultations even more difficult and potentially limited access to some forms of treatment, particularly those that arrive in person. So you may not even get access to treatments that you had before. What does a woman do in that situation that may be facing these additional barriers that her male counterparts may not be?
I think one thing I always say is, you know, there are always issues with healthcare, right? And I think what can women do to improve their own health? I think self-care is very important. I think how do they manage their condition sometimes when the treatments are not available? So there are other ways that they can take care of themselves. Clearly, we always hear, you know, eating the right diet that's right for them. Also exercising to the extent that they can, you know, reducing the stress around them. So there are other ways that they could manage their condition. So again, you know, what I would say is not take it for granted that sometimes there are always these treatments and there's a lot of frustration, sometimes not even getting the right diagnosis. But how do you stay sane through all of that is to at least pay attention and take care of yourself.
And do you think there's a role to become more of your own self-advocate and assert yourself a little bit more if you're not getting the response you are looking for, or at least the response you think you deserve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny when I've been in situations where, you know, I've gone and seen new doctors and I'm asking all these questions and then suddenly they pause and ask me if I'm in the healthcare field. So clearly, and then I see a change in the way they communicate with me. So I think, and I've come across, particularly in the migraine field, I've come across some great patient advocates who are very well informed, so and very well educated on their disease and you know, on the condition. So I think definitely, I think there is room for that. Women need to learn, educate themselves and ask questions. I think, you know, sometimes your doctor may not have answers for everything, but at least when you go in prepared and ask questions, at least there's an opportunity to have a conversation.
So at the policy level, I should say, what work is occurring to change the status quo?
I think that's a very broad, broad question. There's a lot that is happening, at least in the United States, when it comes to women's health. Right now, the focus is on maternal health at the moment. And recently, the House here in Congress passed the Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act, which is a collection of 12 bills. Or one of the bills that was passed was Protecting Moms Who Served Act. So this is focusing on veterans' maternal health. So there's a lot of focus on that because the United States has not been great in the past few years when it comes to maternal health. So a lot of changes happening there. But there are other things that are happening too. I think this is a great time to be here, and have the focus on women's health.
I think a lot of people in the audience are women and are very acutely aware of some of the challenges faced within the migraine space. But a lot of these access issues and maybe being dismissed by your doctor, we know that that's rife within the migraine field.
Yeah.
Is that also the case in other diseases as well?
Some of the same issues that I hear in other diseases too. So you're correct on that.
And what can we learn from how other diseases are tackling these same issues? Can we compare notes and maybe speed up some of the process or some of the access that we'd like to see for women?
So interestingly, I've worked in so many other diseases and conditions, so I do see some common themes. And I think what, again, I've seen is advocacy is very powerful, especially patient advocacy and collective voices, you know, of patients getting together and asking the right questions. So let me give you an example, right? If you ask an average woman on the street what's going to kill her, she'll say breast cancer, but turns out it's heart disease that's the number one killer for women because the breast cancer community was so strong and bonding together to come in and do the advocacy work. That's why women think that they have a higher chance of getting breast cancer. So I think advocacy is very powerful and the migraine community has some very great advocates and the community is small and they all, you know, they can do a lot in bringing about change.
Stigma for migraines, one of those things that comes up time and time again. It seems to get in the way of more research. It gets in the way of more people seeking treatment. And it also seems to get in the way of becoming an advocate. It's a lot easier to be an advocate for something that isn't as heavily stigmatized. And I know that breast cancer wasn't always perceived in the light that it was. It originally was stigmatized. It was a woman's issue and it was neglected by the medical establishment decades ago. And it's taken a fair amount of effort and marches in the streets to change that. Do you feel like for a stigmatized condition like migraine, it's going to take a similar movement and momentum to create real and lasting change?
I think there's already a lot of conversation and I think change is happening. That's what I see. So I think people are aware. And I think the more you speak about it, I think you can overcome the stigma, right? And it's surprising to me when you tell somebody that you have migraine, how many people actually say, oh, by the way, I have migraine too. So I think it's more about awareness and actually speaking up about migraine disease and not just, you know, shying away from it. But I think that makes a huge, huge difference.
Are you involved in any policy work for migraine specifically?
No, not specifically, not in migraine.
Is there any work that you know of that's happening in that space for migraine?
I mean, there is conversations about getting more funding for migraine. More funding to the National Institutes of Health. So I think there is some effort being made there. There's some effort being made about, you know, having screenings done for migraine at the primary care level. So there's some efforts that are going on at the moment.
And of course, we have Headache on the Hill, which was in February this year. That's something that's been going on for over a decade now, which has been a consistent effort by that wonderful organization working on our behalf. Does policy change take time?
Yes, it does take time.
And why is that?
I think it's just the nature of things. I think, you know, policy, again, remember, I mean, anything at the federal level takes time. And then, you know, if you're doing advocacy, which is at the grassroots level, and then trying to make a change, it takes years. And I think that's why, but it's nice to see, I mean, it took us 30 years to get to where we are, including women in research, you know, and even in clinical trials. And now we actually see there are more women in clinical trials. So there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it just takes time. So I always, you know, you just have to be patient and do what you want to do, you know, if you want to be an advocate.
Migraine has a broad range of comorbidities and risk factors that can make it worse. And one of those is sleep disorders. You serve on the board of a sleep alliance and participate in several sleep advocacy groups. What do you see occurring in that space relating to women?
So there's not a whole lot going on in the sleep and women's space. I think migraine's way ahead. And that's why, you know, I'm very interested in, again, the sleep space. The way I see it, sleep definitely has some connection to migraine. We don't know what that connection is. It could be at the biological level, mechanistic level, but we are yet to find that out. We still have a lot of work to do in the sleep area as well when it comes to women. So I serve on the board of Alliance of Sleep Apnea Partners, which is a patient organization similar to CHAMP. And they're all patients on the board. And by the way, I got diagnosed with sleep apnea when I was actually talking to clinicians and researchers and realized that the symptoms of sleep apnea are very different than men. And sleep apnea traditionally, again, is considered a white man's, you know, condition. And so there was hardly any awareness even women can have sleep apnea just because their symptoms are very different. They're often misdiagnosed as having depression when they go into sleep apnea. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And also there's new work needs to be done to understand the connection between migraine and sleep.
Do you notice that there are people in the sleep community that also have migraine?
I have not personally come across anybody, but I'm sure there are. I mean, I think migraine is so prevalent. Sleep conditions are prevalent too. So I'm sure there are many connections there.
And migraine very commonly, but not always, is associated with pain, right? From the head pain of a migraine attack. What are the issues and challenges for women who are talking about their pain in a healthcare setting?
So it's very similar to what you heard in the migraine setting. Stigma is a huge issue. Not believing that, you know, getting diagnosed is a huge issue. And again, the same messaging where the doctor doesn't believe them. I think it's a similar thing what you hear in migraine that's going on in the pain field. The other thing in the pain field that I do want to bring attention to, just like you said, migraine has many comorbidities. Pain does too. And again, we're talking about chronic pain, which is again at a broader level. But a woman who has chronic pain condition is likely to have multiple chronic pain conditions, which again tells us that at the mechanistic level, these are connected. So if somebody gets diagnosed with fibromyalgia, most likely they will have migraine. Most likely they will go on to develop an autoimmune condition or some other pain condition. We still don't know how these pain conditions are all connected. But again, there's a sex difference there. That means the biological difference that women tend to have more painful conditions compared to men.
Does that suggest that there are likely to be treatments that are more effective for women specifically versus men and vice versa?
Oh, correct. I think that's another challenge, right? I mean, a woman goes in, the doctors need to understand that the woman will have more painful conditions. And so that means the treatment has to be different. And on top of that, which also applies to the migraine, the pain is exacerbated by other factors in women, right? Whether it's social factors, psychological factors, depression is a huge comorbid condition. So I think all those need to be taken into consideration when treating a woman with any chronic pain condition and also migraine.
Are there any kind of treatments or approaches or strategies that stand out to you as being significantly more effective or helpful for women versus men?
I think one thing we don't keep in mind is the connection with hormones that you just said, right? And even with migraine, it's so tightly, you know, it's closely tied with the menstrual cycle. And also on the research side, I mean, researchers have ignored that for many years. And so I think that's something to remember and also see if anything ties back with your menstrual cycle or in between menstrual cycle to indicate if it's even hormonal, and also bring that up with your doctors, you know. But I think that's something women have to be aware of, that some of the chronic conditions that they suffer from could also be related to their fluctuating hormone levels.
And it also sounds like there's some potentially fertile ground for research into who responds best, like if females respond better to a certain type of treatment or a certain class of treatment versus the male counterparts, in particularly as we have all these new treatments that have recently become available in migraine.
So true. And we're not doing that right now. I mean, even in clinical trials, you know, there's a checkbox. You're only checking the box to say if you've included women and men, but you need to do deeper. You actually need to do the analysis based on sex. You actually need to look, are there true sex differences between men and women when it comes to treatment? So I think until we do that and start, noticing those differences and capturing those differences, we won't know. So a great example, actually, Carl, is the Ambien story. I don't know if you've heard that a few years ago, where they found there's a very common sleep drug. And it was found that women were actually having more side effects to Ambien. And then FDA made the decision here, which is Food and Drug Administration, made the decision to cut the dose of Ambien in half in women because they were metabolizing the drug slowly compared to men. So there was a policy decision made when it came to that treatment. But even in the past, there have been it was a government accounting office that found that 8 of the 10 drugs that were pulled out of market actually had affected women. So I think it's so important to understand how these treatments and medications actually work. And if I'm correct, a lot of the migraine treatments too don't seem to work effectively in women. So again, I think it's so important to understand the sex differences when it comes to these treatments.
It's almost like you could take all the research that's been done over the last 2 decades in migraine and then just filter it for just how women responded and see if there's still the same result, or maybe in some cases it might be even better. But it doesn't seem like a lot of that work has really been done at all.
I mean, in pain, actually, there's a lot of, on the basic research side, there's a lot of work that's been done in sex differences. It's just not even translated to the clinical side. And I think that's what needs to happen. I think clinicians need to be also more aware that there are truly sex differences. And I think that's where I see that huge gap, is that translation of that research from basic to clinical that still needs to happen.
And when you talk about that translation of research, are you referring to someone in the lab publishing a paper in a medical journal, sharing their latest findings, through to when I go to the doctor at my local GP, they actually apply what has been learned from that research?
Yeah, so there are many multiple processes, right? So when I'm talking about basic research, I'm talking about researchers, experimental researchers who are working with cells, who are working with mice, and now they're required to actually include both sexes in their experiments. But understanding if there's some differences there and actually even publishing, so there is knowledge about it. And then how do you eventually translate that, into when you're coming up with, new biomarkers or treatments to understand if there are differences in there. And sometimes those sex differences may translate, may not, but again, you need to first look if there are there are true sex differences. And then have that information at hand when you're actually, developing new drugs or treatment. And yes, and that eventually, we're not even there yet. Eventually, if that information is captured, then it may make it into the clinical guidelines. It eventually makes it into the clinicians. So I think that's why I was saying it is a long process there. But again, it all comes back to awareness. And once again, I'll say Ambien was a great story that, there was actually a policy change made because there were sex differences that were found in the way the women were metabolizing the drug.
You mentioned it's a bit of a long process. From the time of publication, how long can it take for some of the new best practices that have been established from that publication to reach our local doctor or even our pain specialist or headache specialist in this case?
I think if I put it in context of the migraine, I think migraine field is very heavy with clinicians, or pain specialists. I think it's very, very much clinical and not much of basic research that is happening, but they don't have as many basic researchers. And I think so it is a little bit of an arduous process, but I think there is a need to have more researchers come into the migraine field. The good thing is there's a lot of attention on migraine right now. So it'll be nice to actually attract researchers from other disciplines who may want to bring their expertise into the migraine field and then contribute what they know, you know, and to help advance the research. And in fact, I do want to call out Association of Migraine Disorders, which is, you know, which they're doing right now, because their whole goal is to look at migraine as a whole body system, affecting the whole body system and or various systems within the body, and to see how these other comorbidities are connected to migraine. And I think that's some of the research effort that they're doing.
In 2019, you facilitated a migraine research roundtable to identify gaps and unmet needs in migraine research. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the findings?
Yeah, sure. So actually, it was at a CHAMP meeting that Dr. Godley and I met, and we started, you know, conversation. And so with my basic research training and with his clinical training and with his interest also in understanding how to advance migraine research, we decided actually to do this roundtable. So we brought together basic researchers, we brought together clinicians. It was very interdisciplinary. We had some researchers who were working in hormones, some researchers who were working with animal models, and then some practicing clinicians. And we just put that meeting together and had a great conversation. It was a day meeting. And I think the participants really appreciated that effort, because they said they had never been in such a scenario with, you know, a basic researcher actually sitting down with a clinician and telling them about their research. So we did put a, you know, write a report, and it's, you can see it's available on the Association of Migraine Disorders website. And basically that one day discussions led to also, you know, coming up with some research recommendations and next steps. And so we've taken some of those recommendations and actually supporting some of that research work right now at AMD.
Fantastic. So we know that migraine still has a lot of opportunity for further research, and there's so many different areas we could go into if only we had more researchers and funding. But are we better today than we were in the past regarding research in migraine?
I think so. I think we're definitely better. I think CHAMP has been great in bringing also the patient community together. Again, like I said, there's a lot of focus on migraine at the moment. So I think we should just keep that momentum up and continue to make the advances.
How can we continue to make those advances? What can someone in the audience watching this do themselves to help move the migraine agenda forward and increase the number of research or the number of researchers?
I think just talking about it, right? Again, I really believe in that. And I think coming together as a community is so important, and you know, collectively raising those voices and talking about it. So I think already there are some venues to do that. Like you mentioned, Headache on the Hill. And I think participating in events like that, showing up and showing that, you know, you are part of that community and part of that movement. And I think it helps a lot.
Tell us about the nonprofit organization, Healthy Women, that you work for.
So Healthy Women is, it's a nonprofit organization. And the focus of Healthy Women, or the mission of Healthy Women, is to educate and inform women, particularly midlife women, 34 to 65. And the reason we chose midlife is because that's a sandwich generation, right? These are women who are entering into perimenopause, and or juggling, you know, career women, or, you know, juggling with, you know, children and parents, and also who suffer from chronic health conditions. And again, these women also, the focus is on something else, probably not on themselves. So I think that's why Healthy Women, you know, the mission, again, as I said, is to educate and inform women. So they do a lot of educational programs. The goal is to, you know, create, actually there's a whole disease condition section that you will find on Healthy Women website, but it's a purely a digital platform where you can get a lot of information on just not just health and health wellness. And then we also have now the policy and research arm at Healthy Women. So you'll start to see more and more work come out of those two arms.
Out of curiosity, what are the biggest disease groups that or communities that you have in Healthy Women?
So we don't focus on any like disease groups. I mean, again, there's just information that we put out on different diseases and conditions. But personally, what I have seen, the disease groups, I mean, there are some very big ones. The American, you know, Heart Association or the heart community is pretty big. The breast cancer community is pretty big. So I don't know if that's what you were asking me.
Yeah, it's so obviously migraine is part of, you know, healthy women in terms of some of the information, and then obviously some of the community have migraine. I guess I was wondering how migraine kind of sits compared to breast cancer or cardiovascular disease, for example, or any other groups that might be, you know, significantly part of the healthy women community.
I think at Healthy Women, I think the focus for us is really on the perimenopause to menopause transition. I think that's where. So whatever we do address, any disease, any condition or any issue, it's with regard to the women that impacts the women age 34 to 65. So for example, you know, we may talk about reproductive health, but it depends on what part of reproductive health that we may want to talk about. So if you want to talk about pregnancy, it might be because women who are older now are getting pregnant. So we will discuss the topic within that context. So, but again, there are many, many diseases or many conditions that Healthy Women works in. So, but I think the best way to find that out is to go to healthywomen.org. And again, there is a tab under disease and conditions where you will see, you know, a lot of information and resources.
So you mentioned before that most of our audience are women, and I'm sure that they'd love to know more about what tips you'd give them about becoming their own advocate.
Again, I think I've said this before. Don't be shy. I think speak up. You have to be your own advocate. I think nobody knows you better than yourself, right? And I think don't let anybody dismiss you or put you down. I think you have to, you know, be very clear with your communication, especially with your providers. And be at it, you know, until they hear you and hear your concerns. But besides that, I think, again, I just want to reiterate that taking care of yourself, sometimes the treatments may not be available to you. Doesn't mean you lose hope, but there are other things that you can do to take care of yourself. And I think, again, take a holistic approach, look into everything that's available, and that may help you manage your condition better.
So clearly there are barriers for women to overcoming health challenges with access and support. But we are in a better position today than we were yesterday, and hopefully tomorrow will be better still. Can you offer a message of hope to our female viewers?
I think the hope is, you know, I mean, especially for, you know, migraine sufferers. I mean, it is very hard. But again, you know, be part of the community, you know, speak up. And meet people, other people who are going through the same journey as you, and get that support. So again, I don't want to paint the bleak picture when I say that there's still knowledge gaps and there's not enough research. We're definitely in a better place than we were a few years ago. So get, you know, be engaged in an issue that you care about. And I think that'll help a lot. And again, you know, educate yourself, empower yourself with information. And you be part of the change, you know.
Where can people learn more about you and the work you're doing?
So I'm in social media. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. I am in the process of setting up my website. So in a few more weeks, I should have a website. So that's where they can find me. I'm also on Twitter.
Dr. Malapali, thank you so much for joining us on the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you, Carl.